Hey, yeah.
He had a 750-pound crankshaft in the airplane.
Oh, yeah.
For Bear Creek Mining at Nyack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I used to go into Nyack out of Bethel quite a bit.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, there's a big mining outfit over there.
That's right,
to the east of
New York.
Bethel.
They call it the New York Dredge Company.
Right.
What happened then when you got into Lake and Russell Merrill had taken off?
Yes, he hadn't taken off, he'd started on foot. First, he had left with his sleeping bag. He wanted to be able to get in and sleep on the way. But it got too heavy for him, so he came all the way back from a mile out or something like that and left the sleeping bag, and he told this on the note on his diary. That diary is in the Flying North, just word for word.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Russell Merrill's.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started out again, but he put everything down. He was a Navy-trained pilot,
mm-hmm.
and he was used to putting notes down mm-hmm. continually mm-hmm. on anything that he did.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. Oh, it was a sad story. He'd say, "Beautiful day here. No knoll. No sound. Haven't heard him." Short words, you know, short sentences. Again, no sign of Noel. You know, and it was getting pitiful. He had left 8 days. I get to that now. He had left 8 days before we found the camp. We knew he'd be either dead or he'd be out on the coast somewhere. Mm-hmm. So Matt Niemannen went directly north to the coast, and I went to Cape Halkett.
Mm-hmm.
You know where that is?
Yeah, right up the west corner of Harrison Bay.
Yes, uh-huh, a little bit east of our direct course.
Mm-hmm.
And I went direct to Cape Halkett to get someone from there with dog teams to go out. Well, on the way home, Matt was following the beach, which was bare of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And he found Robertson and Clark. They had left 8 days before Russell Merrill had.
Hmm.
And they were about dead. Huh?
The two photographers.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes, I see.
Yes. The two Fox film men. And they were about dead. This Clark, Charlie Clark, was Fox film's best photographer. And he was heavy, 240 pounds when he started, and he'd lost 30 or 40 pounds, I forget which, when they found him. And both of them, their lips were so swelled and black, they could hardly talk, cracked and bleeding. And their face was just as black as could be from the exposure of the snow, the sun and the snow. And Matt took both of them on in. He said, Charlie Clark says, "We had gone as far as we could go because he couldn't walk anymore. The tendons in his foot back here were gone completely. He was walking on his heels.
Mm.
His front of his foot was coming up. They'd been walking through this crusted snow.
Mm-hmm.
And he was heavy and he'd break through.
Mm-hmm.
And the front of the foot would come up. Mm. They had rubber packs. Regular old-style rubber packs.
Yeah.
And there was something in the back of the packs that cut in, too. And he couldn't walk anymore. He was just all in, terrible shape. Robertson was a little better as far as feet go. But they said, we were going to lay right here and die. We just couldn't go any farther. And it wasn't worth it. We didn't know where Barrow was.
How far from Cape Halkett were they at that time? They were still in Harrison Bay?
They were 30 miles east of Barrow. That's all I remember.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And John Hagness, who was a store owner and keeper at Cape Halkett,
mm-hmm.
started out right away after we arrived there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I was alone, I believe, then. But I got him to go out. He started out immediately. And Oh, he went nonstop for 10 hours or so, and he found Russell Merrill, who had just arrived on the beach, but was about to die too. He, when John, the way he explained it, he was a former Nome sweepstake dog team winner to Nome to Candle via Council and back.
Yeah.
He was one of the winners way back, a good man on with a dog team. He just kept on going till he found him, and he found him right in the trail, on the Barrow Trail, you see. And he said, "I saw him in a distance. It looked just like a polar bear. They looked dark or black at a distance," he says. "I was sure I was running up against a polar bear." And I was only 300 feet from him when he was still walking. 300 feet from me, he laid down in the snow, a little bit on the side of the trail, and he said he was sound asleep, and I was trotting right along with the dogs. It took no time, 10 seconds or so, maybe 15, to get to him. He said he was sound asleep already, and he had to shake him to wake him up. And he was okay, except he says, "Well, are you headed for Barrow? I wonder if there's a chance to bum a ride with you." And he has that, or she has that, in Gene Potter has it in that book.
In the book, yeah.
And he, John Hegner says, "Oh, I don't know. I have an awful heavy load. I doubt that I can take you." "Well, that's fine," Russell Merrill says. "I'll make it. I'll make it. That's good." And he says, John says, "No," he says, "I'm out here looking for you." He says, "I'll fix up some," he fixed up some of that light meat broth. What do you call it?
Bouillon.
What?
Bouillon. It makes a broth.
Yeah.
It's soup, like a anyway.
There's another cube. Name for it. They come in cubes.
Yeah.
He says, "I'll fix up a hot drink for you here right away. We'll have you on the way in no time." So he did, with a little thermos, Primus stove, and he began to feel better right away. Put him in the dog sled and kind of covered him up. And he said it wasn't very long, then Merrill began to moan, hurting bad. And he says, "Uh-oh, he's colorblind. I mean, sunstroke or something."
Snowblind.
Snowblind. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was simple words. Can't think of. He said he became snowblind. Mm-hmm. And it's lucky, he says, that I got to him.
Just when he did.
Well, just when he did, because Russell was. Taking his snow glasses off, he could see a little better at times, and for two or three, up to 8 days that he'd been walking, and the time over there, 8 days before he left the airplane, he was really getting in bad shape, his glasses off. So he was in bad shape, moaning all the way into Barrow, but he got him in there in no time. He just pepped up those dogs, and they never stopped, 30 miles. Got him in there, and of course I had flown over then, but I didn't see, because I took off right away as John Hegness left Cape Halkett. So I was in Barrow. And, you know, it's awful hard to see a man on a trail, or I might have picked him up myself with the skis on there on the trail, but I didn't see him at all, and I kept looking everywhere, of course. And I was in Barrow, and then some native came rushing in and said, "John Hegness has him, and he'll be in here in a little bit." So the other two were recuperating then in the hospital there, and Russell Merrill was brought in, and he was pretty bad shape. He'd eaten rotten whale meat at a cache he found, and he'd also shot with his automatic 22 pistol, little Colt, I guess they are, lemmings. He had a terrific appetite, and he could, when he was hungry, he could eat anything. And between the lemmings, raw lemmings, and this sour whale meat in a cache, he got terribly sick at Barrow. Stomach was in awful shape. And I remember Miss Gordon, a public nurse, was there, and she eventually flew back in. I flew back to Kotzebue I forgot just how we maneuvered that, but I eventually, I went down to Kotzebue, and maybe I went all the way to Fairbanks, because I picked up Ralph, my brother Ralph. We came back to Nome, and then up to Kotzebue to help fly Russell Merrill's airplane out. We knew how to navigate to it then, because the snow was leaving the ground, and we could tell the lakes and the rivers, and we found it right away. The ice had water all around the edges by that time. That was 27 days after we'd gone down.
By that time, it's getting into June, isn't it?
Yes, that was in June, and the 13th of May to just around, right close, the 15th of April, 12th, 15th. So I brought my brother up there, and my brother Ralph flew it on. Now we have to get a propeller first, because Merrill nosed over trying to take off.
Oh.
He had no shovel, and he used his snowshoes trying to shovel down a little bit. But that was almost impossible. He nosed over right away, being light on the tail and the small tires, and bent his prop. So Sir Hubert Wilkins and Eielson that same spring, 28, the time he flew the Lockheed Vega over across, had left a propeller, a spare propeller, and this was adjustable on the bench in the hub, MacArthur blades, that, I don't know who made them, but it was a good propeller for the same engines, because he had a J5 in there, and the J4 are the same hub. So we took that prop out, and took the blades out of the other one, and put them in, my brother Ralph and I, and he flew the Hamilton, the Travel Air over, because the rear cockpit, he was used to that. He hadn't, if I remember right, he hadn't flown the Stinson yet. Front cabin. I should have let him in a way, being that belonged to the Anchorage Air Transport, I should have probably let him, but he said he wanted to fly that, it'd be natural to him. And flew it into Barrow, without any trouble, on wheels, landed on the sand spit there, where I was landing. And then, a couple of days or so, Merrill was ready, Miss Morgan and Merrill were ready to leave for the south, and we went back by way of Kotzebue and Nome. Ralph flying the Travel Air, and I was flying the Stinson, and we put Merrill flat on his back. He was still very sick. Flat on his back in my Stinson, because we had really no seats in it anyway. We used baggage mostly for seats. And I think Miss Morgan sat on baggage back there so she could be handy for him. And we flew on down to Kotzebue. And I think we got on to Nome the same time.
What happened to the Fox film men?
I had taken them out.
Earlier?
Earlier, when I went down to pick up Ralph.
Well, did they get their film made?
No, they were way too late if we'd gotten there right away.
For the whale hunting?
For whale hunting.
Yes.
The whale hunting was over almost a month before.
I see.
all over with. But they stayed, they stayed there for a while and got walrus and seal pictures. They wanted to get something.
Yeah.
Costing Fox Film Company a lot of money.
I was just curious, whatever came out from that?
Yes. We got $1,500 for the trip up there, the one trip. The second trip we weren't paid for. Yeah, the second trip I had to make up with my brother Ralph, we didn't get paid for that, but we got the one trip, and Russell Merrill and his company got paid for one trip.
That was a tremendously hazardous trip. You could all have...
Oh, yes, we could have. We could have been out there, all of us.
Sure.
You know, and that walking was so tough.
Oh, my, yes.
That neither one of those fellas would have made it. I don't believe, because
had
the two said
home.
They were through, they were going to die right there. It was much easier to die right there on the beach than to go on. Mm-hmm. And 30 miles is a long ways when you are in that shape. No food. Mostly chocolate that they had. And Robertson was in bad shape stomach-wise because he couldn't take chocolate.
Yeah.
And that was the last of the rations they had. We thought we had lots of rations that were good for all of us, but I was the only one that had a fairly easy trip, except for worry and trying to get to the right place. I used up 500 gallons of Red Crown gasoline in that old J4. I remember that. Cost us a lot of money, too. And we were just tickled pink to have any kind of gas up there. And we had to try and find them. Yeah, it was bad. And the Fairbanks competition were not interested in coming out to pick us up or to look for us. They wanted to let it go as long as possible. Yes.
That was very helpful.
Pilot wanted, or Bennett wrote about company, Bennett and Thompson Company wanted $5,000 put in the bank in Fairbanks before they would strike out to look for us. They didn't like the Barrow area anyway, and they were not...
That was kind of like Columbus sailing off the edge of the world when they went over that Brooks Range.
That's right.
And it still is for a lot of those bush pilots and helicopter pilots that go up there that have never been up there before.
Oh, sure. It's all new.
I flew the slope steady and lived on the slope for 11 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of those Anchorage pilots would come up there on charters and all, you know, and they'd hit the north side, and it would scare them to death when they didn't see any trees up there.
Oh, that was a horrible sight, you know.
But I'll tell you one thing. The airplanes have changed. Radio facilities have changed.
Yes.
There's stations all over the North Slope, but the weather hasn't changed any up there. It's still the same old weather as when you were up there.
That couldn't change much.
Right.
No. Well, they didn't come out, but they were, the pilot was ready. I'm not going to say who it was. The pilot was in the cockpit of his airplane ready to go out, and he was to get $1,500 if he just went out of sight of Fairbanks toward that direction of Livengood. But he was still waiting for a shower to go by when Matt Niemann's wire from Kotzebue, he'd come back down as soon as we found him. He took off immediately to come down, send a wire to Kotzebue to tell him that we were all safe. And the wire came in, and I remember Ewing Scott was the leader of the expedition. He just about broke the taxi man's back, pushing him to speed up, get out there before that guy takes off. He was so mad at this company in Fairbanks competition for not wanting to go after all of this time, you see. And Fox Film Company in Hollywood were just wild. They sent that $5,000 up right away to help them get out, see? Well, he was to get this $1,500 if he just took off, which would be mighty easy for him. He was a good pilot, and he flew all around this central area here. And they got out there, and the engine was running. He was sitting in the cockpit, just ready, but had a lot of time, of course, to amble around and himself, tying himself in and such. And Scott got out there and rushed to the cockpit. He says, "They're all safe. The flights are all off. No need for any flights." He was so mad at that company, he would have done anything to keep them from going or having to pay them anything. Hmm. So, they didn't get a cent out of it.
Served him right.
Yeah. Served him right. And this pilot went over to Nome while I was lost up there. We were lost. And Ada, we weren't married yet. This was 28, see? And she was very inquisitive. I was still going with her, and then 27 on to 29. She'd danced with this pilot and asked if there was any chance. "Do you think there's any chance that they're alive yet?" "Oh no," he says, "they've been gone. They're just, you cancel out on them," he said. "They're gone." That's what he wanted.
Wishful thinking, I suppose.
Yes,
that's a terrible thing.
We knew them so well.
Tragic?
They were dirty competition here.
Yeah.
Mean type. But they weren't the helping type at any time. Well, we shouldn't talk that way, but
it's a fact of life, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It happens, you know.
But when there's someone missing, you like to save their lives.
Well, that's true. I remember driving up the Alaska Highway in 1951. A car went off the road, and another car went past it and didn't help them, and that man could only buy gasoline on the rest of the highway. The word went up by some means or another that he was to be sent on his way. He was no longer welcome because he didn't stop to see about the car that was had gone over the side
of
the road.
Was that Alaska Highway?
That was on the Alaska Highway in 1951.
Oh, 51.
Yeah, recent times, you know, but it was 10 years after the war. But that was our first trip over the highway. We came up to Alaska in the 40s on the ship, but we drove up the first time in 51. And I can remember we were talking about, well, the old Alaska spirit is still on the highway, even though everything else is modern. Still, there is some spirit of loyalty, you know.
Yes.
And that was the way it was in Alaska. In the hearts of most people, it was save your buddy, you know.
Yes.
Maybe you the next time.
On the Alaska Highway, they should know that people wouldn't be stopping unless not for a criminal purpose.
But it was ethics, you know, and I think aviation was pretty much like that.
Yes.
That's true. But that's been pretty much the way it's been down through the years. Everybody would go out on searches and look for other pilots when they were down.
Yes, that's right. We spent an awful lot of hours searching for other pilots, competitors, our worst competitors. I hauled them all in free of charge if it happened that they wanted to get in. But they always charged, our two worst competitors always charged for any passenger or
that's
pilot
too bad.
Flight.
That's too bad.
Yes. Well, there are some that are that way.
Sam White told me a cute story one time. He said he was flying up on the Arctic, and I had asked him about whiteout conditions. And he said that he had come down through the white fog, and all of a sudden he saw a band of caribou. I think he was running out of gas, and he had to make a landing, and he didn't know what he was going to do. And as he came over this hill, he didn't know what it didn't, you know, there was nothing to see, and suddenly saw the caribou, and he says, that was it. He says, I sat right down in the herd of caribou because they gave him something to see. And he scattered caribou everywhere, but it gave him a base to the ground.
I think he told me about that, yes.
Did you ever make any forced landings in the whiteout condition?
No,
I
never have, except the one to Barrow, and we forced down, but the sun was shining, I could see the snow good before the fog rolled in, but it wasn't very far from us where we landed. Rolled in the next morning, frost stuck up half an inch on the snow everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The frozen fog.
Hmm.
I said, well, there wasn't much chance to fly under that.
Right. Yeah, you wouldn't have lasted long.
No, very true. Would you like to report a little on my first flight from Anchorage to Fairbanks?
I sure would like to hear that story.
That's the first flight between the two points. Well, this Hissel Standard was shipped from Minneapolis. Marvin Northrop built it up, took the OH-5 out, put a Hissel 150 in it, and I was waiting in northern Minnesota. I was flying a mapping for Curtis Northwest Airplane Company, Minnesota Power and Light, up at Grand Forks, Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And just waiting for this airplane to be ready and shipped. And Marvin Northrop called me and said, well, it's ready, and I want you, you should be down here to take a passenger train the morning of such and such, so that you will arrive in Seattle about the same time as the freight train, and it'll be loaded aboard the Northwestern for that week, and you will take Northwestern then. So there, I had to leave this mapping job in the middle of it. We could have had it done long before if we'd had clear days, but scattered clouds, cumulus and such, they can't map. It's got to be perfect clear. So the mapping, it was 8,200 feet.
Was this photographs?
Photographs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. An aerial mapping camera. Mm-hmm. Those big ones stick down through the bottom.
The old Fairchild.
Yeah, the same as that. This was a K6 standard, a K650 horsepower Curtis engine, six-owner in line. It was a good engine, too. And we were doing very well, climbed to 8,200 very quickly. But only about half done, so they had to get another pilot, and I had to leave right away and took off for Minneapolis, Robbinsdale Airport, Minneapolis, and took the train. We arrived in Seattle and boarded the Northwestern the next day or two, and we went up to Seward together with the airplane sitting on the deck. Wings were crated, and the fuselage was covered but open, and then boarded the Alaska Railroad freight, hauled the airplane up to Anchorage, and assembled the airplane up on the field, which had just been finished a week before.
Hmm.
Well, Rodebaugh and Bill Yonker, my mechanic, knew exactly when to be ready, so that's what they wanted to do. Carry passengers in Anchorage, because there'd been no airplane there flying passengers. Felt we could carry quite a few at $10 each, two at a time, make a little expense money. So we did that for a month. And that was the middle of June. I had my 26th birthday on board the boat on the way up. I was 26 years old then.
On what date was that?
June 8th. Uh-huh. So...
you're another Gemini, is what I was thinking.
Oh, yes, yes, Gemini is right. So, we carried about 175 passengers, $10 a piece, and then we were there over the 4th of July, and so I went up. I'd just come from the flying circus, you might say, doing stunts. So I made loops, quite a number of loops, five or six in succession, then climbed on up into a 4,000-foot solid ceiling. And I climbed and climbed with no instruments at all. I didn't care if I'd stall and fall into a spin, because that's what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Spin out of this ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a great kick out of that. It's the first time I'd done it, but it worked very fine. And then I made, I was spinning out of the clouds and came down to about 2,500 feet, then did some more loops, and then some more. I got so I could make a barrel roll, beautiful, with an old big-winged Hissel Standard out of a loop.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I'm coming down out of the loop, Well, I got an air current from the other loop that would roll the airplane if I'd just get it started over, and it'd just make a beautiful roll. Then I do wing overs and all the way down to the ground, just stalls and dips like this, see, without being too dangerous in any way. But Anchorage had the first
quite impressive
aerial stunting, and
oh, what a thrill! You did the first aerial stunting in Anchorage, then?
Yes. Oh yes, yes. Hissel Standard was good for that.
Sure.
I made
that's the, you know, all these firsts. You know, I don't recall seeing that particular first.
Oh, uh-huh.
I know you did everything in aviation first up here, but
well, it just happened that way.
Sure.
It could have been any other person who was flying at the same time if Bill Junker had recommended him to come up. So it could have been anybody else. But maybe they wouldn't have lived as long.
Now, how did Bill Junker get start this project of your coming up?
Well, he was the aviation owner and expert in Rochester, Minnesota. And Jimmy Rodebaugh would go out for physicals and such at the Mayo Brothers, Rochester, Minnesota. So he was interested in aviation for Alaska. Olson had been up here the year before with the Jenny. So he got acquainted with Bill Junker, who was also an auto mechanic for a garage run by a man named Reed. It's a big garage downtown Rochester. So they got well acquainted, and Rodebaugh contacted him for the flight up, I mean for a job, to come up with these two Hissel Standards that he would be buying at Minneapolis, Northrop Airplane Company. So sure, he was willing to come up. He had a big family of 7 or 8 children down there. He didn't want to leave for too long. He left Fairbanks that fall. He couldn't stay any longer. But anyway, he was the one that contacted me then through Marvin Northrop. Northrop, I guess, knew where I was through the Curtis Company. And therefore, I was hired to come up with the second airplane, and I was tickled to go. This was a new venture. And you know, knowing a little about geography of Alaska, I knew all the other main towns, Nome, Sitka, Juneau, and Point Barrow, of course, and Anchorage. I even knew Anchorage, but I'd never heard of Fairbanks before. And that was an early mining, 1902 was started. I hadn't heard about it, hadn't looked at the maps close enough to distinguish it as a larger town, see?
But well, now, you were going to tell us about your trip up the railroad. Honey, do you have to go?
No.
Have you got any time?
I just wait for the telephone.
Okay. Tell us about your trip from Anchorage to Fairbanks.
Oh, yes. Then flew for a month there and had this gas tank built by a fellow named Gil. Gil had a house with 3 or 4 children on the airport, right on the edge of the airport, just south. He had a homestead there, I believe, and he was a good man. He had a shop downtown, and he built this 35-gallon tank for us to put under the center section in order to make a nonstop flight to Fairbanks, because we didn't know of any airports on the way. So he did, and it worked fine, and hooked it up with a valve to the lower tank so we could turn it on. We took off at 3:30, I think it was 3:30 one morning when the weather seemed good all the way, but we hadn't heard about the smoke in the Tanana Valley. No one had let us know about it. Jimmy Rodebaugh hadn't said anything. Maybe he didn't want us to know about it. Come on up and try it. Anyway, he's anxious to get that airplane up here. So we had a fine flight. I flew at 8,000 feet, I remember, across the range, across the pass, watching the railroad, but cut corners here and there. And then I saw this wall of smoke. It was up to Nenana, but didn't go beyond, so we had no trouble coming low over Nenana and then starting following the railroad from Nenana. But there, a little bit hazardous, I thought. I didn't know anything about the railroad coming on into Fairbanks, and there were hills all around Nenana, and so here it got thicker and thicker as we followed the railroad, and I had to come lower and lower, and I think my average was 100 feet over the railroad just to clear the treetops along the sides and see quarter mile or so ahead at a 45 degree angle like this. And the railroad was coming up, you know, that makes you kind of dizzy seeing that close.
Oh, yes.
Railroad here. And I was looking for sharp turns or tunnels.
Yeah.
Now,
all of a sudden, here could be a mountain and a tunnel.
Yes, if it had been a tunnel like I had seen at Healy area, and I expected it, or a very sharp turn in a canyon or something. And a canyon that I wouldn't want to fly down through, because headed down, it's hard to turn back in a narrow place. And I was plenty worried. But this tunnel didn't come up, and the valley was quite wide. Made a turn there before you get around Esther Dome. Mm-hmm. That wasn't so bad. And then finally we saw the experimental farm on the left, on my left, following the railroad. Well, I knew Fairbanks had to be right close, because I'd seen the map and the distance was about right and the timing of flying. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long it took me from Nenana, but an hour, probably an hour or something like that, and maybe less. Then came the college. College had been built there in 1922 or something like that. A few buildings there, the main building. Then I knew that Fairbanks was just a mile or two farther on, but I still couldn't see Fairbanks. It was that thick. Finally, I came right over the powerhouse, and there was Fairbanks and Chena Slough. Well, it was easy enough to fly around Fairbanks and stay low, see? Mm-hmm. I found Weeks Field right away, so I had no trouble in coming in, and then I'd heard something about Ben Ileson nosing over his de Havilland mail plane there on one of the last flights he made to McGrath, and went over on his back in the center of the field. And Bill Junker had told me, stay to the right if you're coming in headed west. And that was easily visible. I could see where the south part was, having had the experience in the States on small fields. So I had no trouble landing on the right side where it was hard. Made a good landing and was greatly relieved, naturally, getting out of that smoke, which was too thick to go anywhere.
Terrible.
And for 2 weeks after that, we couldn't go anywhere. I tried taking Jimmy Rodebaugh and Luther Hess. He was a mine owner and big stockholder in the bank here. He was well known in the central area, and his wife said later, she says, "My, but I was worried. I didn't think you were old enough to be a pilot. You'd taken my husband out there up in nowhere, see?" "I was sure worried," says, "you were too young." Well, I looked young at the time, full head of hair, nice dark hair, you know.
And your family is Austrian? Is like Vienna?
It came from there originally, but came to Norway. Someone from there came to Norway. In the early days in Norway, they called them estates. And the estates kept the name of the former owner. My dad was born on the Wien estate or farm.
I knew you were Norwegian, or I'd heard this, but at the same time I couldn't associate the name.
Yes, entirely Norwegian.
Yes.
That is, my mother was Swedish.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
My dad was Norwegian, and they both came from old country. And we were all born, except my younger brother Harold was born in Lake Nebagamon, Wisconsin. where he was working for the Weyerhaeuser Company sawmill, big mill there at that time in the early 1900s. I was born there in 1899. My brother Ralph, 98 or 97. He was 16 months older than I was. So we were born there, 30 miles south of Superior, and moved to northern Minnesota. It was called Oshawa at that time. Now, been for 40, 50 years, it's been Cook, C-O-O-K, Cook, Minnesota, 30 miles north of Virginia in the Mesaba Iron Mine Range, Hibbing, Chisholm, Eveleth, Gilbert, those towns, just 30 miles north. It was pioneering up there too, just wagon roads out. We were 6 miles west of Cook, and the wagon road was so poor that we went by boat down the Little Fork River. And my dad wasn't there to do it. He was working in Virginia, in the sawmill. But another fellow by the name of Charles Elliott took us down in a boat, and we had to portage two different rapids in the Little Fork River to get to our homestead. I was 5 years old.
There was one question I was going to ask you, and that is, when you first started flying up here, did you have any conception of what was going to happen to aviation in Alaska or to the development of Alaska?
Well, you know, being young and little experienced, I didn't even give that a thought, but I did know that there would be more modern airplanes coming up as the years rolled by. But you know, in your fondest dreams, you would never dream of what type of expansion there would be. I just had no idea. I thought of it many times, and that we should have brakes and we should have cabin airplanes with good air-cooled engines, but never the faintest thought of a turbine engine or jet type of engine. Oh, that was absolutely unheard of, see? Yes. But then in later years, my brother Sig and I talking quite often about turbines. Turbine is an efficient type of engine. My brother Sig especially thought of turbines long before they were used.
Is that so?
Yes. Yeah, he had a foresight on that sort of thing. Quite inventive.
Well, your original one or two airplanes grew into quite an establishment.
Yes, from the Hisso standard and on. I'm sorry that we didn't save that Hisso standard.
Yes, of course.
But at the time we needed money so bad, so that $750 was a great help.
Well, you started on a shoestring.
Oh, absolutely.
And you put a tremendous amount of work through the years into maintaining the airline.
Absolute shoestring. I had to borrow my $300, put my share into this $750 to buy the Hisso standard. And Gene Miller put in another $350 each, $700, and my...
And that carried one passenger?
Two in front.
Two in front, I see.
Yes, two in front. And my brother Ralph, his third share in the airplane was doing all the work after hours.
Hmm.
So I had to pay that $350 back. Maybe it was $300. Kind of slipped my mind, but we needed a little extra to buy gas. And
that's
a fellow here, a sourdough, he was, Phillips was his name. He ran the Horseshoe Cigar Store in Fairbanks. Loaned me the money without a note or anything. Just gave me the money, and he says, pay me when you can. So I paid him quite soon after that. The first thing I wanted to do, and interest on the money. It was 8% interest or something like that.
Hmm.
And I was tickled pink to be able to borrow. I couldn't go everywhere, even in Fairbanks, and borrow. I could have possibly done it, but wasn't too much money floating around in Fairbanks at the time. The mining was slow, and he just borrowed this. There might have been some that would take an interest in it and want to keep the interest, see, and we didn't particularly care to have too many bosses telling us what to do either. So I was fortunate. I didn't have any money when I came in that spring of 27 back from Minnesota. I'd been out 1 year then, a whole year.
You'd been away a year?
Yes, uh-huh. Mm. And I had been, the reason I went out was that I was to be a pilot on the University Alumni Expedition headed by Robert Anderson Pope. It was three or four universities in the East that were going to do this, and they were going to buy Douglas airplanes and Leigh Wade, a round the world pilot in 1924, one of the four pilots, was to be the leader of the pilot of the pilots in the expedition. Another fellow named Reed, who was now living in Winnipeg, but he was a trained American pilot to begin with. But there was a great aviation up in Canada at the time, and he had gone up there. But he was quite an old-time pilot, experienced in the Arctic. And myself, because I'd been flying here quite a while then, you see, in 1926. Well, 2 years. Wasn't much, but they'd heard about me. I'd been lost, you know, and there were red headlines everywhere when I was lost at Toklat. Portland paper, I know, had,
you know, really, somebody ought to write this as a, your biography is a tremendous story. It hasn't, I know Kate Kennedy's little book, I was looking at it here earlier, The Wing Story, but
that little one, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Most of that.
But there is no regular full biography out about you. There's
Well, there is now.
Is there? Well, is
it's
there?
It's just about to be published. It's
I see.
At
I
the printers.
Oh.
And it's being written by Ira Harkey, but we've been 5 years.
Who was Ira Harkey? I know the name.
He was here as a Carnegie. Oh, what do you call it? To the University of Alaska.
Uh-huh.
Carnegie.
In, was it in English?
It was in editorial work.
Yes, or, yes. He taught journalism up at the university.
Journalism.
Sure enough. Uh-huh.
One season.
I didn't take a course with him, but I met him. I know who he was.
And Chuck Keim, you probably know him.
Sure, I know Chuck real well.
He was the one that got us together and insisted that we do something about it now.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And he was a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yes.
This fellow, and Chuck Keim liked him very much. Well, he's a newspaper man. He'd had a newspaper 13 years in Mississippi, mm-hmm. and he was from a wealthy family in New Orleans, and I guess he was the only child of the people that had a wholesale grocery company in New Orleans.
So that book
That's
is
how it started.
Out. Well, I'm going to, I'm looking forward to having one of the early autographed copies from...
It'll be out in October, we're hearing, but mm-hmm. it's at the printers, and what do you call these things that they send back, showing the cover and...
The final proofs.
Yeah, the final proof. There is a copy of it here, and we were so surprised. Oh. It almost knocked us off our feet.
What have they got on the cover?
Well, there's a picture of my biplane Stinson.
I'm going to make a bowl of soup for us. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I've had a lot of cheese here. I'm not really hungry. I don't think I had anything to do this afternoon, except here.
Your secretary hasn't called.
I better call my wife and see if something has come up.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she wants to shut that off then until... You have a phone, do you?
Yeah, right
around
the corner there.
I get a little stiff in my old age sitting down so long.
I kind of wondered about that. Can I give you an arm?
Oh, I'm all right once I get up.
Okay.
I'm not quite as helpless as Bob Reed is. Yeah. Oh, right here.
Yeah.
Michelle wants to know where the sprinkler is. You turn the room.